before the cameras, forensics experts donning their gear. I went to Snail's truck and sat in the front passenger seat with the door open, brought out the photocopy of the diary and began reading through it again. I didn't want to leap to any conclusions about the connection of the bomb to the book. Yes, what had happened to Chief Campbell looked like murder. The duct tape on the wrist was a sure sign, even if one accepted the highly improbable idea that he'd chosen to commit suicide by bomb when he likely had a perfectly good gun in his possession. I needed to find something in the diary that connected the idea and the crime. The first pages were all about guns. I spread a page over my knee and looked at the photocopied pictures of two handsome teenage boys. The page was a study of the Columbine killers, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, who'd gone on a shooting spree at their local high school in Colorado, killing 12 students and a teacher, and injuring 24 others. I knew the story. I'd read a couple of true crime books about it. The diarist had made a list, beside a doodled sketch of the wolfish Harris, entitled Successes. 1. Kept the circle of conspirators small. 2. Surveillance of victims for maximum impact. 3. Covert weapons purchases. What was this? A list of the things the Columbine killers had done right in their evil plan? Was the diarist comparing and contrasting the massacre plans of high-profile shooters to come up with the perfect kill plot? I flipped the page. More about the Columbine killers' work. Excerpts from the boys' diaries and maps of their school. There were 5 pages dedicated to the Columbine shooting in the diary. A sickly feeling was creeping up from the pit of my stomach. I ran my fingers over a note at the bottom of the last page on Columbine. 13 victims, it read. I can beat that. Chapter 16. Elliot Cash had come to the open door of the car and leaned on the window, folding his thick arms on the sill. I reached for a cigarette. I figured I was going to need one. I've had a chat with Victoria about our operations, but I really want to sit down with you before this thing kicks into high gear so you can download my concerns, he said. The priority right now needs to be security. I want maximum operational confidentiality throughout this case. We need to keep covert information tight. This is a small town, and we know there's a lone wolf or possibly a terrorist sleeper cell hidden within it. We cannot afford unplanned leaks right now. I exhaled smoke into the thin morning air. I have so many problems with what you just said, I don't even know where to start. Oh, really? Yes, really. I looked at the town in the distance. You want to sit down with me so I can download your operational concerns? Who the fuck gave you authority over this case? I did, he scoffed. I'm federal. Did you miss that? How could I? Maximum operational confidentiality? Who talks like that? I do. Yeah, you and G.I. Joe. Well, you know, I'm the Fed in this relationship, so I'm in charge. You'll be in charge when we establish this is radical Islamist terrorism, I said, flipping the pages of the diary, which, if this diary gives us any indication, is going to be never. There's nothing even mildly Islamic-looking in here. All I can see thus far is praise for dickhead white boy school shooters. That diary is pure terrorism, and I'm the terrorism expert, so I have jurisdiction, he said. Nope. Yes. Nope, I repeated. You can have jurisdiction when the Attorney General flies his big golden helicopter into the middle of nowhere, waddles his fat ass up the hill to where I'm sitting and tells me you have jurisdiction. I put my feet up on the dashboard. Until then, it's a 3-way partnership. You, me, and Vicky. Cash laughed, leaned in. Officer Snail's experience is in chasing down lost cattle dogs and wrangling drunks out of the local pub. She'll be useful for local intel only. I ignored him. My next concern is with your presumption that I'd leak operational information even if this was a federal case. Are you serious? Of course I'm serious, he said. He reached into his back pocket and pulled out a folded sheet of newspaper. I couldn't stop a grimace rising to my face at the image of me on the front page of the Telegraph, my legs splayed over the body of Prosecutor Wolfmeyer. I looked like a pint-sized Wonder Woman action figure, my breasts straining against the ridiculous blouse. I tried to contain my fury. Is this not you? Cash gave a crooked, patronizing grin. Ah, fuck off. No one told me I was going to have to babysit an insubordinate, dangerous state cop while I was posted here, he said. This was supposed to be a very exclusive task force, me advising the local authority. He jabbed a thumb in Snail's direction. That's how it works for this type of case. You get an expert in, and he infiltrates, taking the suspects down when they show themselves. If I have to have you along, I don't want any of this kind of behaviour. He thrust the newspaper page at me. I let it slide to the floor of the car. Maybe you're feeling hostile because of your brother's situation, Cash said. Maybe you're always like this, and that's some indication of why Samuel did what he did. I don't know, but I don't want you going off half-cocked and hurting someone on my watch. I'm going to need you to keep it contained while you're out here, officer. I'm going to need you to call a dentist. I put my legs down, leaned into his face, because the next time you talk to me like that, I'm going to kick you in the mouth. We watched each other. Only Snail drew our eyes away, approaching the car, her notebook still in hand. We've got our first lead, she announced. A suspect. It's not good news. Chapter 17. A group of men in a Cobras had assembled by the edge of the road, talking animatedly, now and then pointing towards the town. Angry and unable to look at each other. This didn't bode well. Snail had managed to rein in her grief, but she had the sunken look of someone who had much crying to do yet. She stood beside the passenger side door with Cash, looking in on me. Chief Campbell retired about 6 months ago, Snail explained to me. I'm the only cop on active duty in the town. It was a long handover, and sometimes Soupy would help me out if I needed it. He got special approval to keep his handgun in cuffs for that very reason. Everything's been fine. You know, the usual sort of stuff. Drink driving is my main problem around here, but I've been having some troubles with this kid named Zach Taby and his little crew of misfits. How old's Taby? I asked. 15, Snail said, one of our senior students. You guys have got your own school down there? I looked at the tiny town below us. It hardly seemed to have enough buildings. Of the town's 75 residents, 12 are kids, Snail said. There's a little schoolhouse behind the post office, 2 teachers, 5 seniors and 7 juniors. And those guys reckon this Taby kid's written a diary, I said. Makes sense. The book's full of praise for idiot teens, so they think they're looking for an idiot teen. Who are they, anyway? They're just local farmers. Snail glanced back at them. They say they've seen Taby around the junkyard over in Tibberborough playing with engine parts. He's basically everybody's first suspect when anything happens around here. I've questioned Zach, but I wasn't convinced he had anything to do with the diary. What made you so sure? Snail shrugged. He's been in and out of the station a lot, and I've always had him write statements of what's occurred. Zach hates writing. Why would he spend hours upon hours constructing a handwritten diary? If a kid's interested in something, they'll put in the effort, I said. What's Taby's religious background? Cash asked. Not sure. If you want to go to church around here, you've got to drive all the way to Fowler's Gap. That's Catholic. There are no mosques out here. So he might be Muslim. Cash had perked up, like a dog catching a scent. I don't know, Snail shrugged again. He's Pakistani. His is the only non-white family in the valley. People have always given the Tabby family a hard time. Problem isn't just whether the Tabby kid is responsible for this. It's that people think he is.
What do you mean?
Once things get reported as facts in small towns, they remain fact. And people decide facts for themselves out here. There was a rape over in the next town last year. Everybody decided it was the local plumber who did it. He had an alibi and everything, and the DNA didn't match. But once people had decided, that was it. They ran him out of town. Snail already looked stressed. She walked back towards the men on the side of the road. Cash beckoned for the diary on the seat beside me.
"Probably you better give me that," he said. "It'll be safer in my custody. I'll do an analysis of the content and draw up a report."
I didn't move to hand him the diary. He raised an eyebrow, his hand out, waiting. "I'm not playing this game," I said.
"What game?"
"This one." I pointed to his chest, mine. "This territorial crap, this stupid dance where you tell me to step off, wave your dick around, puff your chest out. That shit doesn't work on me."
"It doesn't?"
"Nope," I said, "and I'll tell you why. I'm looking at you and I'm guessing you're about, what, 30 years old?"
"I'm 33.
"Right," I nodded. "I'm 36. My brother and I were removed from my mother's care when I was 2 years old. She was a prostitute, a drug addict. I spent 16 years in foster care," I said, watching his face. "I don't know how many homes we were shuffled through. Sometimes Sam and I were together, sometimes we were apart. We never stayed anywhere for more than a year. But in each and every family, the kids would tell me the same thing as soon as I arrived. This is my house. Those are my parents. You don't touch my toys. You don't hug my mum. You don't belong here." Cash's defiant frown had softened a little, if only with confusion at my candidness. I leaned forward so that he could see that I meant every word I was saying. "People have been telling me to fuck off out of their territory since before you were born," I said. "And for all those years, my answer's been exactly the same." He waited. "This is my house now," I said. Chapter 18. Wit squeezed along the packed aisle and settled near the middle of the row of spectator seats to the left of the courtroom. Above him, the press gallery was all looking at their phones, updating their editors before the morning session began. As Harriet's brother was escorted into the huge space in his crumpled suit, a hush fell over the crowd. Wit tried to catch the man's eye, but Sam's stare was on the back of the courtroom. Today, expert witnesses would testify about Sam's mental capabilities. The frail, big-nosed Dr. Hemsill had taken the stand and avoided eye contact with Blue as he read from his report. "We can infer that much of Samuel Blue's troubling history is directly attributable to developmental issues caused by his mother's use of illicit substances during her pregnancy," Hemsill said. "His tests show low patterns of stimuli reaction in the prefrontal cortex and amygdala, which we know are areas of the brain affected by substance abuse in utero. The prefrontal cortex controls a lot of our civilizing, inhibiting behavior. It's what stops you lashing out or acting violently, for example, when you're experiencing rage." Wit thought about Harry as he made notes. The times he'd seen her kick down doors, throw things, charge forwards with her fists balled when the stress of her situation became too much. He tried to shake her out of his head. "Impulsivity is something we see often with these kinds of brain activity patterns," Dr. Hemsill sighed. "Reactions to emotion rather than logic. Blue's social abilities are also greatly hindered by his neurological patterns. He has trouble with empathy. He can be abrasive, hard to relate to. He naturally finds it difficult making friends at all, but when he does make them,
His loyalty endures beyond reason. Whit had accidentally written Harry instead of Sam in his notes. He crossed out the name, but circled the word empathy, tapping his pen thoughtfully on the page. Harry shared her brother's wild, unpredictable personality. She was abrasive and hard to relate to, but she did not lack empathy. Whit had spent a couple of weeks in the desert with her, watching her toss and turn in her sleep, watching her struggle under the almost physical weight of her worry for whomever the Banjo Mind Killer would target next. She'd been broken-hearted after a spider in their cabin had been found unceremoniously squished. She felt things for others. In fact, sometimes Whit thought she felt them too keenly. She would take the crusades of others on as her own responsibility, fight for people who didn't want or didn't deserve it. Whit had lost himself in dreaming. He rubbed his eyes, looked around. At the end of his row, a man with a closely shaved head was sitting with his hands on his knees. Whit didn't know what it was that drew his focus to this man. Perhaps it was his attentive presence in the distinctly sparse seating area reserved for supporters of the accused. Whit and the man were alone on the bench, and the bench behind them was empty. But no, it was something more. Whit realized that almost every set of eyes in the courtroom was focused on the large screen behind the witness stand, where Dr. Hemsel was pointing at parts of the human brain lit up with different colors. But the shaven-headed man's eyes were on Samuel Blue. The man was not just staring, his gaze was locked on Blue, like a cat with its attention fixed on a bird. The hairs on Whit's arms were beginning to stand on end. Something told him to commit this man's face to memory. He looked at the notebook before him. Perhaps he could make a sketch. He took up his pen, but when he turned back to examine the man again, he was gone. Chapter 19. I sat at Snail's kitchen table with my head in my hands, listening to the officer rattling around the kitchen, scraping food together for her two city guests. It had been a long day, and when Snail showed us to our accommodation, my space, a single fold-out bed at the end of her large enclosed porch, I felt the desire to fall into the sheets and bury my face in the pillow. It was a struggle to keep my mind on the diary that lay open in front of me. Snail came to the table with her notebook in her mouth and two wine glasses in her hands. "Don't drink it all at once." She put a glass down before me. "Wine's expensive out here. They only do a supply run every 2 weeks." Without warning, there came a grunting, scraping sound. I almost spat out my first sip of wine when an enormous grey creature emerged into the narrow hall from the front room. The pig was at least a metre and a half long, covered in a fine black fur and a smattering of speckles. It trotted lazily into the room, looking me over with little interest. I felt the first smile of the day crack my face. "What the fuck?" "Look," Snail sighed. "There are 33 adult men in this town. 30 of them are married, one's 70 years old, and the other two aren't interested. It gets lonely out here." I laughed. "You could have a dog." We watched the enormous pig sprawl out on a blanket by the door, giving a long guttural groan as it flopped onto its side. "Jerry is a real presence in the house," Snail said. "His footsteps are heavy, and he snores really loud all night long. Feels like there's someone here." Cash finished a phone call and joined us. Forensics had arrived that afternoon and completed a once-over of the diary for DNA and prints, so we could touch it now. We'd also handed off the plain red backpack the book had been found in. The backpack looked new, and nothing else was in it. That was odd. Why not just carry the notebook by itself? Was the red backpack meant to attract attention from the roadside? Did the diarist want the book to be found? I perused the pages quietly while Cash and Snail chatted. The writer had indeed done some extensive investigation of bomb-building options, focusing on explosives that could be made from everyday household objects. The ideas seemed to emerge out of Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris's failed attempts to blow up their school cafeteria with gas bottle bombs before they went on their rampage. "Let's get the handwriting analysed against all the handwriting samples we can collect from the town," Snail suggested. I made notes, a list of to-dos. "So this is the preliminary breakdown of the Campbell scene from forensics today?" I asked, pulling Snail's notebook towards me. "Yes, classic propane bomb," she said. "Seems to the team that Theo would have been sitting with the gas bottle either between his legs or wedged under the chair when it went off. He was sitting facing the town." She sighed, long and deep. "His wife, Olivia, is in tatters, just beside herself." "Does she have any idea about suspects?" "She wasn't very coherent," Snail said. "Says Theo was over in the next town fixing a mate's roof, someone called David Lewis, and then he was going to stay for dinner. When he didn't answer his phone, she figured he must have stayed the night. I'll go back to her for suspects in a day, maybe, give her time to get over the shock." "Let's go talk to David Lewis, see if Theo was acting weird." "Right." "Any sign of someone else at the crime scene?" Cash asked. "Maybe," Snail said. "There were footprints. Smeary, hard to tell the tread. But looks like an ordinary old work boot. Size 7 men's, 9 women's. Looks like a person pacing back and forth, not far from the blast site. But they can't really date the prints. Could have been a day or two before. Theo's service weapon is missing, so someone must have got hold of it. Used it to coerce him into the chair." "Where did the chair come from?" Cash asked. "Surely the killer didn't bring it with him." "There's a bunch of junk up there on both crests, on the roadsides in and out of town," Snail said. "Kids go up there and smoke and throw things off the cliffs. Every Saturday night I go and do a sweep through the bush there and down in the gully, make sure they're not doing anything too naughty. The chair was probably from one of their little campsites. The duct tape, I don't know." "Yes, the duct tape. Where were Theo's handcuffs?" I asked. "I'd be surprised if he had them with him. Neither of us have ever really bothered with them," Snail said. "I haven't cuffed anyone in the 10 years I've been out here. Things never really get that out of control. And I know every single person who lives here. There's nowhere to run, so why try to get away?" I turned to Cash, who was staring at the wine glass in my hand. "Propane bombs, are they hard to make?"
"Not at all. They're the terrorist in training's favourite improvised explosive device," he said. "Simple design, easily obtainable ingredients, any idiot can make one. You get a gas bottle from a backyard barbecue, duct tape a can of petrol to the side of it, take the cap off, put a wick in, light it up and run away, boom." He threw his hands up.
"So we could literally make one right now," I scoffed, "with Snail's barbecue gas bottle?"
"You could make a bunch of different bombs with stuff lying around here." Cash took out his mobile phone, showed it to me. "I could crack this open, find the wire that connects to the ringer, expose it so there's a little spark, dump in a bottle of something, make a call to it, there you go. Mobile phone activated bomb."
"But where does a person get the knowledge to put these things together?"
"The internet," Cash said.
"Surely people send up red flags with your agency when they search for stuff like that," I said.
"If every teenage boy in the country who ever searched for how to blow something up earned a file with ASIO, the department would cease to be operational."
Cash was eyeing Snail now as she drank her wine. "We don't identify terrorists by their Google searches. That's amateur hour. Let's get all the IP addresses in town anyway," I made a note. "Check everyone's internet activity."
"Why soupy?"
Snail's lip quivered. She sipped her wine to cover it.
"Why pick him? He was an absolute doll. Someone's pacing back and forth. They've got him taped to a chair with a bomb between his legs, facing the town.
It's a good view from up there. You can see everybody. All the houses.
Everybody can see you too, I said.
It's very showy, Snail said. A demonstration. Either for Theo or for us down here. A spectacle. Only the timing wasn't great. No one awake to see it. Was it a practice shot? Or was Theo the audience? Was he supposed to see the town spread out before him just before he died?
I liked Snail's musings. I wanted her to continue, but Cash spoke up.
Look, I don't mean to interrupt, but are we going to be making drinking a part of our ongoing investigative practice, or is this a one-off drinking session?
Snail and I looked at each other.
Don't get me wrong, you've both had interesting lines of inquiry so far, but we're shooting the breeze about this case over a bottle of red in a dining room like a bunch of old ladies.
Would you like to move to the garage? I snorted. Should we appoint a chairman? Let me guess. It should be you.
There is a violent terrorist in this town. Cash took the diary from in front of me and waved it in my face. Is the seriousness of the situation escaping you?
We are taking it seriously, Snail huffed. We're just cooling off, that's all. It's been a long day. I had to go tell a woman her husband was blown to pieces all over a hillside today.
Well, I'm sorry, he shrugged. Guess I'm just not on the same page as you two. When I was on an assignment gathering intel in Afghanistan, I was seeing guys being blown to pieces all over hillsides every day, and it only toughened my resolve. I think we shouldn't drink on the job.
He got up and traipsed away into the living room. I let my eyes wander to the shell-shocked Sergeant Snail.
That was hilarious. I took a sip. I think my wine actually tastes better now.
Let's look through this diary. She pulled the book towards her. We're going to catch this killer, with or without him.
Chapter 20. My sleep was thin. The diary had disturbed me deeply. There was a detailed profile of Sung-hee Cho, the Virginia Tech shooter who'd killed 32 people on campus in Blacksburg. Once again, the diarist had listed the elements of Cho's massacre plan they seemed to find useful for their study. 1. Chain doors, trapping victims. 2. Made detailed manifesto video, so reasons would be known. 3. Low personal profile. Maintained non-threatening reputation before attack. Cho had acted out of a seething rage, making a rambling video manifesto while kitted up for a massacre. His cap turned backwards. The sullen, dark-eyed young man talked about a fiery demise for his enemies. I lay in the dark, his words bouncing around my brain, visions of his victims running for their lives flashing against the backs of my eyelids. I was starting to get a mental picture of the diarist. If he or she had decided these were the attributes of a successful killer, then surely they'd be putting these behaviours into place in the lead-up to their own plan, whatever it was. They'd be maintaining a low profile, keeping quiet and resisting the temptation to bring collaborators in on their mission. They'd be trying to obtain weapons without raising any eyebrows. It wouldn't be hard out here. Every farmer in the town would have a gun. It would only be a matter of amassing them on or just before the day, once the killer had worked out where they could all be found. I tried to tell myself to sleep. Without sleep, I'd never catch this guy. I was drifting in and out when the sound of grunting broke through my consciousness. I thought at first it was the pig. I climbed off the end of the bed and went to the porch screen door. Cash was out there in the barren dirt yard, a barely visible black streak against the rise of the distant ridge. I pushed open the door, still mussed from sleep. He was shirtless, a rippling, sweat-glistening torso lit up as I switched on the backyard light.
What the hell are you doing?
He was jogging back from the end of the property. He ignored me, dropped and did 10 seamless perfect push-ups.
The muscles in his triceps looked surgically carved.
"Are you nuts?" I continued. What time is it?
It's 2 a.m.
Why are you working out at 2 in the morning?
If you want to bring down the enemy, you've got to think like the enemy, he said. He'd huffed rhythmically through 10 jumping jacks, dropped for more push-ups. Think, act, live like them. This is a classic training regime used by the Taliban for their frontline fighters. They conduct sessions at early morning hours to train the brain out of its circadian rhythm. They can eat, sleep, and access high levels of physical energy whenever they need to.
I watched, bemused, as he took off again towards the back of the property. He sprinted back and dropped to complete a set of sit-ups.
You're a bit of an addict of this stuff, aren't you?
What stuff?
The terrorism gig.
Don't knock it just because you're incapable of it.
Incapable of it? I squinted. Of what, exactly?
Of the lifestyle. Of the kind of commitment it takes to work in national-level human security. I mean, there's a reason you're a cop. You want to protect people. But if you were capable, surely you'd do it at this level. He gestured to himself with one arm as he did push-ups with the other. Not that level. He pointed at me.
You know, I've met some colossal douchebags in my life, Cash, but you're slowly climbing the ladder to number one.
Number one? He mused. Sounds like me.
You're not even doing those properly, I said. Your chest is like 10 centimetres off the ground.
Is that a challenge? He asked.
I'm just saying. If you're going to run around training like a lunatic in the middle of the night, there's no point doing a half-assed job.
A half-assed job. He stopped working out for the first time since my arrival.
Are you serious?
I don't joke about push-ups.
You wouldn't last the end of this workout, he said. I guarantee it.
Right, I snapped. I went back inside, slamming the door, dragging my bag from where it lay at the end of the bed to search for my shoes. Agent Cash had no idea what I could withstand. In a life like mine, full of darkness and pain, a tough workout was child's play. Chapter 21. The workout was invigorating. My quiet exhilaration heightened when he announced ruefully that I'd completed it. My body screamed through dozens and dozens of burpees, joint-grinding squats and panicked sprints to the end of the yard and back. When I knew he was looking, I scratched my nose with one hand during the push-up sets, the other arm continuing on through the exercise with what I hoped looked like effortlessness. I finished drenched in sweat. There were no congratulations from my new partner. He trudged off towards the house in silence. I sat in bed making a list, light beginning to creep under the curtains drawn closed around the glassed-in porch. The porch was creaky, and when Jerry the pig came out to join me at sunrise, the whole thing rattled like an old wooden wagon. The huge animal stood snuffling at me for a while, its big brown eyes searching mine, then flopped to the floor by my bed with an exhausted sigh. Snail was right. The snoring was oddly comforting. I lay on my side and watched the animal's ear flapping now and then as it dreamed. Its body warmth made my corner of the porch cozy. I fell asleep to thoughts of Sam's case. I had so much that I wanted to do to help my brother, but all of it was out of my hands. There was so much evidence against Sam. Not least his confession. I walked up behind her. I was quiet. I swept my arm around her neck, pulled her backwards towards my car. Sam confessed to all 3 murders. But less than an hour after leaving the interrogation room, he said the confession was coerced. I didn't want to believe that my own colleagues might have psychologically tortured my brother, exhausted him and threatened him until he simply surrendered. Maybe they'd beaten him. I'd been known to get a little rough with suspects myself, inside and outside the interrogation room.
but I also didn't want to believe that Sam was guilty, so I tried not to believe anything. Marissa Hayden had disappeared from the university grounds in a small car park behind the campus bar on a quiet Tuesday afternoon. My brother's credit card records showed he had been in the bar that same afternoon. El Ramon had disappeared from a street 3 blocks away from the university, in the residential area behind the main street of Newtown. Sam usually walked home that way at around the same time she'd gone missing, from his graphic design business in Marrickville, where he worked the 3 days a week that he wasn't teaching. Rosetta Polar had disappeared from a side street off of Parramatta Road, near the university's veterinary science building. CCTV inside a bicycle shop captured Sam walking through the area just 15 minutes before Rosetta was last seen. Sam had been at the right place at the right time for all three abductions. Police had been watching him, and they didn't like what they saw. He was single, he was antisocial, he had a history of juvenile crime. If he was as violent as his sister when he lost control, he might be deadly. The task force had jumped in and made an arrest, even if the evidence was flimsy. The media had been hounding them for progress. Even a false arrest at that point would have been something. That night, things took a turn. The police had found worrying evidence inside Sam's apartment. Some violent porn, a rape dungeon-style setup in his back bedroom. Those things were circumstantial. There was no evidence of any of the girls at Sam's place, and no evidence of Sam on any of their bodies. But the prosecution could physically place him near all three abduction sites. What were the odds? I woke from a sweaty half-slumber and slid my notebook out from under my pillow. I flipped through the crime scene photographs of the girls' bodies sprawled on the banks of the Georges River. I looked at the trees on the opposite bank, a blur of pale eucalypts in the photograph. Fine grey sand and murky brown water. This place meant something to the killer. What had it meant to us? My childhood had been full of rivers, fields, national parks. Often Sam and I found ourselves in large families with multiple foster children lumped together with biological children. When child services found a willing foster carer, someone who was reliable, they sent them as many kids as they could possibly handle. Sam and I, two moody, aggressive white kids, would become part of an odd collection of youngsters all under the care of one foster couple. With so many kids in tow, traditional means of entertainment were off the cards. Going to the movies was too expensive. The families would take us to parks, rivers, and long empty beaches. Sam and I had spent time at the Georges River, but that time hadn't been any more meaningful than it had been anywhere else. At least it hadn't to me. Maybe there were things about Sam I didn't know. We'd been separated now and then, sometimes for up to a year, when families wouldn't take us both. Maybe there was another Sam, a brother grown out of those blank spaces in his life, the ones I hadn't witnessed. An evil Sam. Chapter 22. There was little to say to Cash and Snail when I arrived in the kitchen in the morning. Cash was reading the Herald on his iPad, a 2-page spread about my brother. "We've got to go," I said, drawing on my cap. As we started walking into town, Cash lagged behind us, talking on his phone. I eavesdropped on his conversation, trying to distract myself. "You can't take that. I bought it. But tenacity, baby. Let me talk for a second, will you?" Tenacity. I'd heard that name before. When I first learned Tenacity Bridges' name, I thought she'd probably had a mother who'd thought she was cool, landing her daughter with a moniker people would cringe at for the rest of her life, like mine. My secret shame, Jupiter, was at least my middle name and not my first, and I'd been able to hide it for most of my life. The tenacity I knew had been a victim I met in my work in sex crimes, A young man named Alex Finson had climbed in through her bathroom window one night and sexually assaulted her in her bed. I wondered silently if the woman Cash was talking to on the phone was the same one. How many could there be? I was drawn out of my daydream by the crowd gathered out the front of the town pub, squinting in the sunlight. They turned angry faces on Cash and me. A sneer twisted the lips of the nearest person. It was only then that I noticed almost all of them were carrying rifles. "There they are," said one man, advancing towards us. Chapter 23. "We want to know what the hell's going on." The man jutted his chin at me, turned and sized up the much larger Agent Cash. "We're hearing the whole bloody town's about to be attacked, and we're seeing Sydney's sent exactly 2 coppers to protect us. This is bullshit."
"Whoa, hold up." Cash put a hand out. "I'm not a cop. I'm a trained federal agent specializing in counter-terrorism."
"Terrorism?" The group glanced nervously at each other, shifted their rifles. "Is it a terrorist?"
"No," I stepped between them. "There is nothing to suggest right now that..." "They're Muslims," someone said. "I knew it'd only be a matter of time." I didn't have patience for this. I was about ready to snap when a man broke into the group, short and pot-bellied with thinning ginger hair.
"Let's keep this under control, Aunt Ace." He put a hand on the rifleman's shoulder. "I'm sure these officers know what they're doing."
The man turned to me, offered a hand.
"I'm John Destro. Everybody calls me Dez."
"Dez is the mayor," Snail told me. The man laughed, showing teeth so straight and white they could have been dentures.
"Well, technically last chance is too small to appoint a mayor. I call myself that, but I don't get the salary." He smiled warmly. "I run the post office, so I'm the most powerful guy in town."
He gestured to a 2-story building diagonally across the road from where we stood.
It occurred to me exactly how powerful a postmaster could be in a situation like this. He literally had a monopoly on the essentials of life out here. Food, alcohol, tools, farming supplies. Paid to be nice to the people who controlled your supplies, particularly when it was a 2-day drive to anywhere with a population above 500. "I'm here to help in any way that I can."
"Of course," I said, "thanks. You can start by telling everyone to put their guns away. There is no evidence of an imminent threat to the people of this town, and this many people running around with rifles and frayed nerves is going to get someone killed."
I walked inside the pub, where the tables surrounding a large stage were packed with people, some of them already halfway through breakfast beers beside plates of toast. There were people on the upper floor, arms hanging over the railing, watching. This is what people do in country towns when there's trouble. Go to the local pub, gossip, get a hold on the situation, regardless of the work to be done that day. The place was the beating heart of the town. There was a sweaty bartender standing behind the long, polished counter, holding a pint of beer to his lips. The glass featured a brass nameplate with "Mick the Prick" engraved on it. I guess drinking on the job was acceptable here at least. I walked to the stage and 30 sets of eyes followed me. Literally half the population of the valley was here. "My name is Detective Inspector Harriet Blue," I said loudly. "I'm from the Sydney Metro Police Department. I've got a few things to say." I drew a long breath. How many of these people would recognize me from the front page of yesterday's paper? Snail was watching me from the doorway with Jace and the hostile group of farmers. "Last night, your former police chief, Theo Campbell, passed away," I said. There was no rumble of voices, no gasps of surprise. "We're still investigating the circumstances and whether they are linked to the diary Sergeant Snail questioned you all about some days ago. At this stage, there is no reason to believe that anyone else in town is under any further threat. I advise you to go about your business. Those people we want to question about the case will be contacted shortly. If you think you've got relevant information to share with us about Mr. Campbell's death or the diary, then please do so. I tried to leave the stage and almost ran right into the solid wall of human muscle that was Cash. My stomach sank.
Actually, he shifted past me to the center of the stage. It might be helpful, Detective Blue, for us to provide a deeper understanding of what information might be relevant.
What the fuck are you doing? I whispered. He ignored me.
My name is Special Agent Elliot Cash. I'm a highly trained counter-terrorism expert specializing in Islamic terrorism and insurgency. I've spent years in Iraq and Afghanistan gathering surveillance and intel on lone wolf and sleeper cell development. The crowd stirred. The bartender slammed a pint glass down. Because of my specialist experience, Cash said, I can tell you the kind of thing we're looking for. You need to keep an eye out for someone you know who's been acting strange lately. Maybe he's spending more time than usual on their own or on their computer. Ask yourself if someone in your household has gained a sudden interest in organized religion, particularly Islam, or if they've been making aggressive political statements. Have they withdrawn from their circle of friends? Are they making or receiving private phone calls in the middle of the night? Hypervigilance is the key here, people. Be aware, and if you see something, say something.
Terrorists, someone at the back murmured. I bloody knew it.
That Toby kid's always on that laptop, someone else said. You see him around town with it. That's how they radicalize them, the internet. The videos, the chat rooms.
I all but yanked Cash off the stage as he tried to wrap up. He seemed confused by my fury. I pushed him out the pub door and into the shade of the awning. Chapter 24.
You are going to panic the people of this town. I shoved his chest. There is no evidence of organized terrorism in this case so far. None.
Maybe not to your eyes, Cash said. You don't have the training or the experience. This is how lone wolves operate. They hide out in small regional towns where their activities don't raise suspicion, and they experiment, honing their skills, until they can move on to bigger targets.
I tried to breathe evenly. Snail exited the pub, shoulders hunched, embarrassed by the public display of antagonism. I had to salvage this situation, if not for the case, for the town's perception of city law enforcement. Threatening Cash, shouting at him wasn't working. His skull was too thick, trapping messages outside his tiny brain. I needed to be calm, reason with him. You know, I said, my training is in sex crimes. I live it. I breathe it. I spend my every waking moment dealing with it. So when a victim or a witness comes to me and tells me their story, my natural instinct is to believe what I've been trained to believe, that a crime has occurred.
I don't see where this is going, Cash broke in.
I took a moment to visualize myself punching him in the face, then closed my eyes and carried on. But sometimes, I said slowly, very rarely, a crime hasn't occurred. Someone is lying or they're mistaken. I have to make sure that I approach every situation with an open mind and look at the evidence before I form any conclusions.
So? Cash shrugged.
So you've assumed there's a terrorist in this town without any evidence to support that, and worse, you've just warned these people to look out for someone acting strangely, who's withdrawn, moody, and who gets phone calls late at night. You know who that sounds like? Sounds like every fucking teenager I've ever met.
Radicalists often target teens, Cash said. They're usually already despondent, disenfranchised, vulnerable to the ideas of terrorist organisations.
I turned to Snail, who was watching Cash with a kind of confused awe reserved for audiences of the truly mad. Find me Zach Taby, I said.
We need to get to him before someone else does.
Chapter 25. I stood fuming while Snail went back to the house to get the four-wheel drive. I couldn't so much as look at Cash, who was now talking to Mayor Dez, probably giving him a rundown of covert surveillance tactics in the rural environment. I was steadily becoming exhausted. It seemed the further I got from the city, my home, the harder it was to breathe. Already the midday sun was baking the air, making it feel like steam in my lungs. 7 days, I thought. It's only 7 days. I noticed the farmer, Jace, standing nearby when he spat on the ground. He was watching me from the shadows beneath his hat. All of him was browned by the relentless sun, black freckles and moles standing up on his arms like cracked pepper. He had a foot propped on the stone front step of the farming supply store next to the pub. "Was there much of Soupy Campbell left?" he asked. I considered the question. It was odd. Not only deeply inappropriate, but slightly voyeuristic, too. "It was a terrible scene," I said. "I can't imagine why you'd want to know." "Well," Jace said, shrugging. "Out here we have pretty simple beliefs about justice. The blackfellas, they have their ways. They'll have the elders sing to the spirits about you, bring down some bad luck. Sometimes they'll have a ceremony, spear you in the legs. Depends on what you've done." He looked me up and down, as though assessing my life's worst deeds. "Then there's the white man's bush justice," he said, "an eye for an eye. Sounds like Soupy's woman won't have much left to bury. Whoever did this, it should be the same for their family." "Look," I let my head loll. "That's very impressive and scary, and believe me, I understand your way of looking at things. I've encountered a number of predatory scumbags in my particular line of work who I'd love to torture slowly with a barbecue fork, but that's not the way the world works." I was mildly uncomfortable at my own words. I had, in my time, tracked down and beaten a couple of sex offenders who had escaped justice. I'd relished in hearing that violent child sex predators got the old Long Bay welcome tea, a bucket of scalding water thrown over them on their first night in prison. That was the violent part of me, the beast inside. But this man didn't need encouragement to go out and punish Theo Campbell's killer with his little band of sunburned cronies. The men I'd punished had endured full fair trials. I'd known they were guilty. The farmer before me was itching for a suspect to hurt, and there was no way he was going to wait to make sure he had the right guy. "Any suspects yet?" he asked, as if on cue. "No. But if we find some, and anything happens to those suspects before we can get them locked up, I'll be looking at you." I pointed at Jace's eyes. "So take your white man's bush justice and fuck off." He laughed at my bravado, gave me another long visual assessment, his eyes wandering right down to my boots, back up to my face. I stood sweating in the sunlight as he wandered away. Chapter 26. Zach Taibbi wasn't hard to find. Snail picked us up in a four-wheel drive and drove us not to the school but away from the town, along a dirt track that rattled the car windows almost out of their frames. We came to a shaded gully at the foot of a tall cliff face covered in spray-painted tags. I got out of the truck and stared at the peppering of cigarette butts at my feet. Somewhere in the shady brush, someone was playing music. A whiny peal from phone speakers. A large black and grey dog rushed to the car to intercept us, barking in a decidedly unfriendly manner. Its stride jangled with a string of Coke cans tied to its tail. Snail sighed, exasperated. "Digger," she snapped. "Come here, come here, girl." The dog gave up its vicious charade and allowed itself to be freed. "Whose dog is that?" "It's the town dog,"
Snail ushered the dog up onto the back seat of the four-wheel drive. No one really owns her. Everybody feeds her, which is probably why she's so fat. A stringy, dark-skinned teenager emerged from the brush. I noticed others scuttling off through the trees, a couple of girls and a tall, lanky young man in a huge black trench coat that was ridiculous in the heat. Zack must have known we'd come looking for him after hearing about Theo Campbell's death. There was laughter on the winds as the teens took the back route into the bush. A couple of defiant cries of, "Fuck the police!" Zack had a practiced surliness well beyond his 15 years. I might have wondered what it took to become this angry at life so young, but I had been exactly the same kind of kid. I never slept. I smoked like a chimney. I swore at strangers and hung out in the wrong places. One of my foster dads had nicknamed me Bitchface because he said I always looked like I wanted to scream at someone. This kid thought nobody cared about him, and he was probably right. "You got some friends, Vicky?" the teen asked, eyeing Cash and me.
"That's a first."
"We need you to come with us, Zack," I said. "We've got to get your parents so we can chat about an incident yesterday morning."
"I'm not going anywhere."
"Oh, yes, you are."
"Suck my dick, bitch," he snapped at me. "I don't know anything about what happened yesterday, so you can go and annoy someone else because I ain't no terrorist. I don't keep a diary. Diaries are for little girls."
"We just want to talk," Snail said. "Maybe you can tell us something that will help. You and Soupy were well acquainted. You might know someone else who had a major grudge against him."
"Whoever it was deserves a fucking medal."
Zack drew a cigarette packet out of his jeans. "Dude was an A-grade fucktard. Heard the bomb blew his head right off. Is that true?" "We don't have time for the tough guy games." I strode forwards. "Get in the car."
"Should I resist?" He jutted his chin at me, grabbed a handful of his junk. "Would that be exciting for you?"
"That's it," I heard Cash mutter as he came up behind me. He pushed me aside and grabbed Zack, slamming the kid into the dirt.
"Stop! Stop!"
Zack was squealing with terror, all his bravado gone. Cash had a knee in the kid's back and both hands in his pockets, scooping and dumping detritus on the ground around us. Cigarettes, joints, condoms, a pocket knife, scraps of paper. Cash got the boy's phone and let Snail and I drag him off the wailing teen. Zack rolled in the dirt.
"Fuck you! Fuck you, police piece of shit!"
"Let's have a look," Cash was saying, swiping through Zack's phone. "Recent photos."
"Stop, Cash!"
I grabbed at him, just missed the phone. "This is an illegal search. Anything you find on there is going to be tainted."
"Says who?"
He held me back with a massive arm, worked the screen with the thumb of his other hand. "I see naked teen girls. I see kids sucking on bongs. What's this?" Cash showed me the phone screen. I glimpsed a mess of wires and tools and glass jars on a sprawling, cluttered table. "Bomb making in progress?"
"Give me the phone," I told Cash, "or I'll take it from you."
He was trying to zoom in on the photographs, backing away from me. I gave Cash a few seconds to comply, then strode forward, lunged and grabbed the hand that held the phone. He was fast, catching my other wrist as I went for an open-handed slap to the side of his head. I dropped and hooked a leg around his, pulling him off balance. He let go of my wrist to save himself from hitting the dirt, and I got my slap in, wrenching the phone from his fingers as he was distracted by the blow.
"Oh, shit,"
Zack was laughing, pointing at me.
"Bitch has got some moves."
I threw the phone at the boy, who only barely caught it against his chest. "Call me bitch one more time," I seethed. "I'll shove that phone so far up your ass you'll be able to Skype your spleen." Cash watched the teen run off into the bush. His face was slowly flushing with colour, one hand steadying himself against the ground.
"That was a big mistake," he told me. "Assaulting a federal agent is a minimum 2 years prison."
"Conducting a search without a warrant is a serious service violation," I said. I was rolling up the sleeves of my shirt. But neither of us is going to make a report.
We're not?
No. I set my feet apart, cracked my knuckles. We're going to...